Oh, hey, I'm Patrick Henry Charles. This is number 0569 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0569. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Susie Vidori, who is the author of the young adult novel Wall of Wishes. It's the third novel of a trilogy.
It was always a trilogy, and that's part of what was cool about it, is I really wanted to write the series out of order and from different perspectives, just to be a little bit more fun for me to write. And so The Fountain is Ava's perspective. The Westwoods is book two. It actually goes back a year. It's a prequel, and it's Courtney's perspective, and it's how all the crazy things that happened to her at the school and how she went from being a regular kid and the wish that she made on the fountain and the place she found herself in because of it, where, quite frankly, when you meet her in the fountain, she deserved to get wished away.
Anthony D.P. Mann is the founder of Bleak December Incorporated.
100% of our focus at this point is on the audio plays. And thankfully, we work with publishers, so we've already got license deals in place so that we know that we're going to be in the black even before we start recording, which is great. So there's been no slowdown here as far as that's concerned. We've had to be a little creative as far as how we record people. But when the pandemic hit, I had just started editing our latest release, which is coming up in a couple of months, and that's an audio adaptation of the 1973 cult classic The Wicker Man.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy, talks about the latest comet to grace the heavens.
This particular comet, we think it comes from a giant reservoir of frozen comets out at the edge of the solar system. So this is even way beyond the orbit of Pluto. And we think there's billions of these in hibernation mode, these comets, just really frozen. It's like minus 180 degrees there. So they're just frozen rock solid. And every once in a while, however, the gravitational pull of the sun pulls them in towards the inner solar system.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0569, was Patrick Henry Charles, who is a musician and a web content creator. Thank you very much, Patrick, for doing the guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program. Much appreciated indeed. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 32-year-old Amber Lynn Giles' attempt to shame a barista at a San Diego, California Starbucks for not serving her because she wasn't wearing a mask, completely backfired. "I've received death threats, thousands," she claimed, "and it's very upsetting. It's very scary." People sympathetic to barista Lennon Gutierrez have contributed to a GoFundMe campaign to give him tips, and that fund has broken $105,000 at press time. He still works at Starbucks and plans to use the money to go back to school, and he has been meeting with a financial planner and wants to donate some of the money to others. But Giles says she wants a cut of the money in the fund and may sue over it. Oh my God. This woman is horrid. She sounds like the kind of person who has a lawyer on speed dial. Or her daddy is one. Well, under the headline of "There's a sucker born every minute," car rental company Hertz was hit hard by the pandemic. People sheltering at home don't rent many cars. And the 102-year-old company, which has been beset with fraud and accounting problems, filed for bankruptcy. But that didn't keep the company from trying to issue new shares of stock, even though it said it had more than $1 billion in cash reserves. It hoped to sell $500 million to $1 billion in shares and noted in the offering that there was a significant risk that the shares could continue to decrease in value and may even end up, quote, worthless, unquote. That last word was used 7 times in the document. After an uproar on Wall Street and a warning from the Securities and Exchange Commission, Hertz withdrew the offering.
Just let Hertz put you in the driver's seat today.
Well, if you want to invest in the car rental business, how about Avis? I understand they try harder. 50-year-old Chen Haigang of China's Shaanxi province credits his good health and well-being to a fitness regime he created and has been following for about 30 years. Instead of doing Tai Chi or heading to the gym, Chen acts like a monkey, walking on all fours and dangling his arms, even climbing trees and swinging from branch to branch.
Ooby-doo, I want to be like you.
Hop-dee-ooby-doo-bop.
I want to walk like you. Talk like you.
Choo-choo.
I often watch the monkeys at the zoo. I thought it looked so fun and I started imitating, Chan said. Since I moved to the city for work, I've spent my free time doing the monkey walking exercise. I never need to see a doctor. Well, I'm guessing some of the medical profession might disagree with that. Recently, Chan has added other animal movements to his routine, such as crawling like a crocodile. He said many people have asked him about his routine, but are too embarrassed to do it in public. Wow. Kind of hard to believe he has followers. People who are devoted to him.
I love the monkey's uncle and the monkey's uncle's ape for me.
You know how they say that basically everything in Australia can kill you? Here's a story that backs that up. Police in Queensland said a driver pulled over for speeding on the highway gave officers a good excuse. He was fighting off one of the world's deadliest snakes. The police service said the driver, identified only as Jimmy, who is 27 years old, was pulled over on the Dawson Highway when an officer clocked him going at 76 miles per hour in a 62 mile per hour zone. Jimmy told the officer he had been driving on the highway when he suddenly spotted an eastern brown snake, one of the most venomous species in the world, slithering by his legs.
Just you wait till I get you in my coils.
It just started to wrap around me. Its head just started striking at the driver's seat between my legs, Jimmy told police. He told the officer he used a knife to kill the snake, which he was able to show the officer.
That's a knife.
Jimmy feared he had been bitten by the snake, but paramedics determined the serpent had not successfully broken his skin. The driver was treated for shock. The snake's not feeling too well either.
This is going to slow down my slither.
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Susie Vidori is a best-selling author of young adult fiction. She is now releasing the third and final book in her young adult fountain series titled Wall of Wishes. Susie joins us via Skype from Calgary. Hi, Susie.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, you know the old saying, all poodles are dogs, not all dogs are poodles. I bring that up because the whole topic of young adult, what exactly to you is young adult fiction? Because, for instance, people debate whether Harry Potter is young adult fiction or not because there's so many adults who read it.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome question, actually. And it's one that has shaped this series. Because on the shelf in the bookstore, there's 2 shelves. There's middle grade, which is like 9 to 12. So think younger series. Some of the first 2 books in the Harry Potter series are actually in that sort of age range. And then they get older and older as they realize that older and adults are reading it. And then there's the young adult section, which is 14 plus. Now, I built this fountain series. I actually wrote for that in between, which is those kids who are super strong readers, and they have outgrown the 9 to 12. They can read those in, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour, they're through those books. And they need a bigger, thicker book that has lots of different content in it, but not that sort of 14 plus, which might be more explicit. So that's what I wrote this series for. And I've been really pleasantly surprised because it sort of does that crossover thing where it also have adult readers because there's a romantic element in it. So that's been really fun.
So tell us about the Young Adult Fountain series and what we can find or what we can learn in Walls of Wishes.
Sure. So the Fountain series is about 16-year-old Ava, and she moves from San Francisco to New England to find out more about her mom, who died when she was 10. And when she gets there, her reputation's preceded her, and the kids aren't very nice because her family had gone to the school. And all kinds of crazy things happen to poor Ava. She gets really upset, and she runs into the woods, and she finds a mysterious fountain. And she makes a wish, like many of us have done through the years, only her wish comes true, and she makes a wish that the girl that she just met had never existed. And when she returns to the boarding school that she attends, the girl is gone, and absolutely everything in her whole life is different. Even her own family has changed. And she has to find out about the magic of the school that she goes to and the history of her own family. She meets a boy, that's the romance part, and it's a mystery. So that's The Fountain, the whole premise of the series. And Wall of Wishes is book three. Like you said, it just came out in June of 2020. So launching in a pandemic was super crazy. But it is really the culmination of the whole series. And so it answers every question that I've ever had from, you know, the thousands of readers of the Fountain series. Every question is answered. Everything is wrapped up. And you find out a lot more about the characters that you want to. And we also find out the fate of the fountain, because the Westwoods in this book, the school has actually sold the Westwoods, which is where the fountain resides. And Ava is very upset because she knows that if the fountain is destroyed, there's a possibility that all the wishes going back almost a century that have ever been made on the fountain might disappear as well. And her father had made a wish, which she's aware of, and he'd wished for her mother's love. And so if that had never happened, then Ava may now no longer exist. And so she's quite motivated to save the fountain, and she has to work with her nemesis, Courtney, in order to make that happen.
Wow. Now, when you first started writing this, did you always envision it as a trilogy, or did it just grow into one?
No, it was always a trilogy. And that's part of what was cool about it, is I really wanted to write the series out of order and from different perspectives, just to be a little bit more fun for me to write. And so The Fountain is Ava's perspective. The Westwoods is book two. It actually goes back a year. It's a prequel. And it's Courtney's perspective. And it's how all the crazy things that happened to her at the school and how she went from being a regular kid and the wish that she made on the fountain and the place she found herself in because of it, where quite frankly, when you meet her in the fountain, she deserved to get wished away. So,
you know, you mentioned releasing this during COVID. If I'm not mistaken, were you not supposed to release this later in the year?
Yeah, it was actually supposed to be released later. And it just kind of came about because I write this sort of in between middle grade and young adult, and there's no shelf for it. A lot of what I do as an author is in person because I meet my readers where they are. So I do a lot of events. So my spring and summer is generally fully booked with traveling Alberta, doing school visits and young writers conferences and Comic Cons and like all these huge events. And of course, during the pandemic, they were all canceled. And I looked around and went, okay, what am I going to do now? So I was like, I've got time and readers, people are out there reading. And so it was just a bit of a challenge. Usually I have a huge launch party and coincide a launch with tons of events. But even for the planned September release, we're not going to be able to have big events like that. I mean, the things are starting to open up here in Alberta, but I just didn't think it was going to happen. So I bit the bullet and we got creative and did all kinds of neat things in June online. And I think it's been a lot of fun.
You're an editor. You're also a teacher, correct?
Yes, and a book coach as well.
And
all things writing.
and a book coach. And the reason why I bring those things up is I'm just wondering how, in doing what you do in those capacities, how has that in any way, shape, or form affected your own writing?
Oh, most definitely does. So I was actually a business executive for 20 years, and I never intended to become a full-time author. I wrote The Fountain, the first book in the series, on maternity leave with my third child. So it was a project. I always wanted to write a book, and it was sort of, you know, people say, well, how did you have time? We have three children at home. I'm very lucky they nap. But yeah, I wrote The Fountain that way. And as The Westwoods came out and I started getting asked to do teaching and speaking and be at events, and I loved it. And at one point, my husband and I looked at each other and I'm like, okay, I'm taking 7 vacation days off as my job as a vice president products at a or operations at a products company. Something is wrong that I'm taking vacation days off to go work as an author. And so I started saying yes to people who asked me to edit, and I started saying yes to people who asked me for book advice, and now I coach people through that whole event of writing a book, right from the outlining through to creating your author platform, all those things, and I love it. It keeps me really in tune. It makes me hone my skills. It means that every time I've written a new book, I'm bringing something new to the table, and it keeps that part of my writing life really alive, and I just love working with other people on their projects.
Okay, so my next question is just purely from a selfish point of view, and that is, when you teach all of the things that people need to know about writing a book from A to Z, do you actually consider Z, which is you've got to spend just as much time promoting your book as you do writing and editing your book?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that people don't really realize when they embark on this journey, is that writing the book is only part of it, right? And writing is certainly, I'm working on 2 different books right now, always writing forward. But writing is just the first step in your author journey, and you've really got to figure out how are you going to get the book into readers' hands, because publishing is changing so quickly, and you can't just put it out there and expect people to find it, right? So I love working on that with people, helping them find their voice. And every time I work with someone else on that, it reminds me of more things that I can do. And you know, pay attention. What are you known for? What do people come to you for? What could be that voice out there that would help you promote your own books and get it into the hands of readers? Because that's really what it's all about. I mean, I don't write books for the love of writing it. I do love writing them. But I write books because I love it when a teen or an adult calls me or writes to me or contacts me and has written a book report or has, you know, shared it with their book club or their friends and tagged me on Instagram. And I'm like, yes, that's why I do it. So yeah, it's definitely only one little thing, but you got to get that part right. You got to write a book that people want to read.
When it comes to writing fiction, there are writers who like to write as they go along. In other words, they don't know the whole story. They write to the story, and there are some that plot it all out and want to know the beginning, middle, and end before they start writing. I'm just curious, what kind of writer are you? Part one of that question, and part two, how do you teach that when you're one of those two things and you have students who might be the other?
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't have a one-size-fits-all approach. I mentioned I love going to conferences. I love learning. I'm currently completing my advanced coaching certificate with Author Accelerator, which is a group out of the States that does book coaching. So there's lots and lots of different ways you can do it. I personally am a quilter. So there's plotters that you mentioned that plot everything out. They might have huge story grids and everything else. There's pantsers that have no idea and just start writing. I'm what you'd call a quilter. I do a very simple outline, and as I get, you know, I'm currently writing my 5th book. I only have 3 published, but I've got one more in the hopper, and then, you know, writing book 5. I can hold a lot of it in my head, but I do write a very simple outline. I think it's important to know where your story is going to end up and what the climax is. So I do what's called like a 3-page outline with most of my clients, but I'm open to doing, and it sort of goes through the scene and the point. And that's from the Author Accelerator program. And I just love it because it's quick and dirty. It gives you some plot points, but it also says what's happening inside your character. And it doesn't ignore that part, because people that look at like 30-page story grids, sometimes they're really focused on what's happening, like what's actually happening, what's the action in the story. And they forget about the part that a book is about, a character's change from beginning to end. And if you don't know how each scene relates to that change, then you're not going to write it in a way that makes sense, and you're going to have a ton of revision work to do later. So I'm a big proponent of having a really simple outline. I call myself a quilter because I write scenes out of order. I might write the final scene first. I might write the climax scene first. I write according to my moods. I still have 3 children, right? They're now 14, 12, and turning 9 this week. But they're around, and especially during a pandemic, we're all kind of on top of one another. You know, they were at home the last 4 months. So I write for my mood, and I pick a scene that I know I can get through, and then I sort of quilt it all back together. But I don't recommend that. It's not the most efficient way. If you can write from start to finish, that's great. But everybody's got different motivators. And as a book coach, I work with different writers to tap into what their strengths are and where they find themselves in flow. Like, when is it that you have sat for 8 hours in writing, or does that ever happen? Or do you write in 1 hour stints? Like, what works for you? And then we bring in techniques from different places and try them. And if it doesn't work, we'll try something else until we get you writing your book.
Quick final question, and that is, you mentioned you have readers that are of all ranges. You write young adult fiction. Were you surprised when you first heard back from people that you were getting an older crowd reading your book?
You know, I hoped for that. Everybody always hopes for that breakout crossover novel. So I really wrote it in a way that would be good. But I'm just so pleased, especially when I hear from adult readers who shared it with their friends. My mom and all her friends have read it, and I know, not just because she's my mom, but people tell me that because it's written, you know, at a very fast pace, they can pick this book up even if they haven't read a book in years. And they're like, oh my gosh, I read that book in like 2 days and I haven't done that in so long, and thank you, right? So that's really cool. I'm really proud of that. And maybe they go on to read other young adult books or be inspired by that to keep reading.
The new one is called Wall of Wishes. Susie, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks so much.
Susie Vidori, author of Wall of Wishes. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0569, and you'll find links to Susie's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about radio drama. We'll also discuss a new comet that is hovering around in the heavens out there. Plus, we, of course, have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. You know, sometimes it's just better to let Dad win, especially after he's had a few drinks. That probably would have been the best strategy for one Kentucky family who were forced out of their home by gunfire after the patriarch lost an arm wrestling match to his son. 55-year-old Curtis Zimmerman surrendered to authorities shortly before 8:30 a.m. at his residence after a nearly 8-hour standoff. Deputies learned that Zimmerman was intoxicated, go figure, and challenged his juvenile son to an arm wrestling contest. When Zimmerman lost multiple times, he became agitated, which led to a physical altercation with his son. Zimmerman grabbed a rifle, and as his son was going upstairs, Zimmerman fired 2 shots inside of the house. Deputies dispatched to the residence at about 1 a.m. determined that 2 of Zimmerman's family members had exited safely and were unharmed. Zimmerman, who was the only one who remained inside the home, refused for hours to obey commands to exit the house as members of the hostage negotiation team and SWAT converged on the residence. Zimmerman told authorities that he had fired the shots into the ceiling. After Zimmerman surrendered, he was taken to the hospital to be evaluated. He will be charged with wanton endangerment. You know, he's going to be wads of fun when competition takes place in the prison yard. Yep, wads of fun. If you came face to face with a scary fish, you would leap out of the water too. Authorities in Hampshire, England, recently were searching for a violent man who was evading arrest. The unnamed 31-year-old male thought he lost the cops by heading into Thornis Bay on the country's west coast. However, the man didn't last too long as he was reportedly scared out of the sea by a large fish. That's right, he leapt out of the water and into waiting handcuffs of police. The man was arrested and charged with suspicion of burglary, attempted theft of a motor vehicle, and possessing an offensive weapon in a public place. It's unknown what kind of fish spooked the suspect.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
But I'm sure the fish is telling all of his friends in the school the tall tale of the big human that got away. Authorities conducted a raid at the Genesis 2 Church of Health and Healing in Florida after the Food and Drug Administration issued an injunction ordering a pastor and his sons to stop distributing a phony COVID-19 cure called Miracle Mineral Solution. You may have heard of this stuff. There have been many stories on newscasts about it, including an expose on 2020. The solution contains the same amount of chlorine dioxide content as industrial bleach. The pastor, Mark Grennan, was named in the injunction along with his sons, Jonathan Jordan and Joseph Grennan. The founder of the church, Jim Humble, was formerly a member of the Church of Scientology and believes himself to be a billion-year-old god of Andromeda. Humble has claimed that the Miracle Mineral Solution is the cure for numerous diseases. By the way, as I said, this miracle cure is nothing new. It didn't start up with COVID. As I said, you can find many YouTube stories going back years, including investigative stories on ABC's 2020 and others, who have spent time debunking the charlatan and his snake oil. In a nutshell, these people are sick opportunists. 24-year-old Natalia Bruno of Newark, New Jersey, survived a harrowing mile-long ride through the storm sewer system under Passaic on July 6th after she drove into high water during a flash flood. Bruno, a driver for DoorDash, escaped her car as it filled with water, but the current pulled both her and her car into the waterway that runs under the city. Bruno rode the wave until it reached its outlet above the Passaic River, where she was shot out and swam to a backyard on the other side. A homeowner called 911 and Bruno was taken to a hospital where she appeared not to be seriously injured. Her Toyota Prius was later found under a street the next day. Excuse me, aren't we missing another victim in all of this? Somewhere out there is someone who didn't get their DoorDash meal. Pray for them. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Anthony D.P. Mann is back on the program. He's the founder of Bleak December Incorporated, a multimedia company. He's an independent filmmaker who specializes in the world of genre tales of horror and suspense. He does both videos and radio dramas. Anthony joins us via Skype from Kingston, Ontario, to talk about his macabre work. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Peter. It's always a pleasure to be on the show. And I have to tell you something. This conversation that we're having today is so timely because we've recently done here at Bleak December headquarters a series of live internet readings of some old radio plays that I wrote back in the 1990s when I was first kind of dipping my toe into this and I was a kid and I wanted to get into radio theater. And those scripts were originally performed live on the Peter Anthony Holder radio show.
Wow.
Starting in 1996, Peter, I just have to say very, very fast, you've always been a mentor to me. And when I was a kid, I used to always look up to you. You know, like when I was a teenager, I looked up to you and I learned so much about radio. You gave me my first crack at it. And then now almost 25 years later, here I am doing wonderful full cast radio plays. And I owe a big chunk of this to you.
Well, you were talented. I mean, When you got in contact with me and you knew I was playing old time radio on the air, And yeah. you offered up the idea of doing live old-time radio in the studio in a late-night radio show. I thought, you know what? This can go one of two ways. It'll either be fantastic or it'll go down in flames. Either way, it'll be memorable. and so why not give you a shot? And you were great.
Oh, thank you so much. And, you know, here we are. And you mentioned that I was a filmmaker. And I guess I shouldn't say that I was a filmmaker. I have been a filmmaker. I made 5 feature films. They're all out there in wide distribution. And, you know, as Rodney Dangerfield said, you know, when he retired the first time, he said, just to show you how successful I was at a filmmaker at the time that I retired, I was the only one who knew that I retired. I made 5 feature films. And then in 2016, I decided to just kind of dip my toe back into something that I used to enjoy, and that was spoken word. I recorded a single of Pose the Raven with a gent, Maurizio Guarini, who is a member of the band Goblin. They scored a bunch of horror films in the 70s and 80s, progressive rock group. And that little single got picked up by a vinyl label in the States called Kadabra Records. And when that was done, they came to me and said, would you be interested in doing some readings for us? And I said, sure. And we did some beautiful records. And then they said, what else would you like to do? And I thought back in the 90s when, you know, I just loved the format of radio theater. And I thought, I'd like to try and take my filmmaking knowledge that's been acquired over these years. And maybe I can incorporate that into creating audio movies, so to speak. But the key is we have to have somebody really interesting in each one of them. So the first one out of the gate was an audio adaptation of Dracula starring the Candyman himself, Tony Todd, as Dracula. And and that was it. The ball was rolling. And we've done a whole bunch of these. And, you know, twofold. First of all, people love them. They're out there on vinyl record with Kadabra and on CD, Audible, etc., with Brilliance Audio. And B, I get to work alongside some of the people that I've always loved, like Malcolm McDowell and Derek Jacobi and a couple of the Doctor Who's and, you know, David Warner and some other wonderful people. So it's been very exciting. And it's so funny because we made more in residuals on our very first audio play than I made with all 5 of my feature films combined, which is still minuscule. But I'm loving it.
Now, well, the last time we spoke, I guess it was about 4 years ago on this program, or now 5 years ago on this program. Anyway, the last time we spoke, you were doing some as films, as I was mentioning, and some radio work, and you were doing it direct to the market. You were actually getting them in stores. I believe you were getting them in Walmart and the like.
That's right.
I'm just curious to know, what has the current situation, the current pandemic that we've gone through, how has that either slightly crippled your situation or enhanced your situation? Because I would assume in lockdown that a lot of people are looking for things to occupy their time, and certainly your work at Bleak December Incorporated is a great way to occupy one's time.
Well, absolutely. And what's wonderful here is that there is a demand for content right now. And 100% of our focus at this point is on the audio plays. And thankfully, we work with publishers, so we've already got license deals in place so that we know that we're going to be in the black even before we start recording, which is great. So there's been no slowdown here as far as that's concerned. We've had to be a little creative as far as how we record people. But when the pandemic hit, I had just started editing our latest release, which is coming up in a couple of months. And that's an audio adaptation of the 1973 cult classic, The Wicker Man. One of my favorite films of all time. I don't know how familiar you are with it, Peter, but it's a classic, an absolute classic. And that was licensed by Studio Canal, and we produced this thing. Brian Blessed's in it. He of Flash Gordon fame and Lawrence Harvey from the Human Centipede films, and I'm in this too. And we're so excited about this that it's coming out. And you know, I was able to spend the first couple of months of the pandemic just really focused on making sure that was as polished as it could be. And we're very proud of it. And now looking towards the future and the next project.
How do you go about choosing the projects that you want to work on? Is it just a labor of love? Is it works that you really enjoyed for one reason or another, and you say, I want to get my hands on that?
I'm doing exactly what that 18-year-old snot-nosed kid did when he picked up the phone and called you in 1996. You know, there's so much money in this industry, of course, in Canada, that, you know, I The work that goes into these, you'll never see the full value if you're looking at it from a monetary point of view. So everything I do, because every one of these productions takes 250 to 400 hours to produce, everything that we do is a passion project. And to give you an example, the biggest feather in my cap, even bigger than the Wicker Man to me, I don't know if you remember an old show from 1971 called The Hilarious House of Frightenstein. Came out of CHCH television in Hamilton. It would start Billy Van as a plethora of monster-inspired characters, and it was hosted by Vincent Price. Well, 2 years ago, I was licensed, and this blew my mind, licensed to revive that series in an audio production. And we got Malcolm McDowell to step in for Vincent Price, and I became the official voice of some of the characters that I used to love, again, watching them on the TV as a kid. And that was a passion project. That took about a year to produce. It was so intensive, and it was triple the length of anything else that we'd done before. But it was worth it, because it's not work when you love something. And, you know, once again, I remember being huddled by the radio listening to old episodes of Suspense or Rathbone of Sherlock Holmes on CJD Radio, on the Peter Anthony Holder Show. I remember this distinctly. That was my introduction to old-time radio theater, and thinking, oh, I'd love to recreate this. And that's what we've done.
And by the way, that was all from my own collection. That was not the radio station's material. That was my own.
Oh, I believe that. I absolutely believe that. And you've always had the most interesting program, be it on commercial radio, or be it in the stuff file format. I mean, you've always got interesting content. It always appealed to me, and it was nice because in the pre-internet days, you brought all these nerds from across the island and the airwaves together. The geek kids like me that were, you know, sort of hiding out. None of our friends at school knew who we were talking about when we were referencing classic Hollywood or TV stars of an era gone by, etc. But you made it cool overnight, and that was so exciting. That was a great motivator.
Now, the name Bleak December Incorporated, where does that stem from?
That stems from a line in Edgar Allan Poe's poem The Raven, which is a favorite. Distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each dying ember wrought its shadow on the floor. It was about 10 minutes to my meeting with my telephone meeting with the lawyer to incorporate the company, and I thought, goodness gracious, what am I going to call this thing? And I thought, oh, okay, well, we've just done The Raven. Think of a line from Bleak December. It just came out. And it stuck with us, and we have a nice little following online. People all over the world are listening to these audio plays. Again, you know, it's not a massive operation. We're certainly a boutique label, but the passion is there, and I love spoken word just as much as you do, Peter.
So again, people can go online. The website is bleakdecember.com, and when they go there, what will they find?
They'll find all the latest information as to what we're up to. I mean, the website doesn't get updated, on a regular basis, only when we go into production with something. So there's usually an update every couple of months. Honestly, Facebook is the best place to catch up with us and see what we're up to. I'm pretty much a one man operation. That pun's 25 years old. I'm still doing this bit. I'm a one-man operation, so the best thing to do is to look me up on Facebook and see all the exciting things that we're up to, because there's always something going on. And once again, we produce these for people who love genre. We're producing stuff that I want to hear, like. You know, I wanted to hear Tony Todd as Dracula or Derek Jacobi as Sherlock Holmes. So I'm so happy to say we made that happen.
And where can one buy the product?
Well, Kadabra Records is, again, they are this wonderful vinyl label out of Syracuse, New York. They produce these works of art. So much time and effort goes into the creation of the gatefold jackets and the vinyl itself. They're beautiful. So for the vinyl aficionados out there, you can purchase those directly from Kadabra, kadabrarecords.com. And Brilliance Audio is our distributor in the digital format, so CD, streaming, etc. They're an Amazon company. They're the world's largest and oldest independent audiobook publisher. And you can purchase the CDs on Amazon or through your local bookstore, or you can download or purchase a streaming file on Audible and all the other streaming sites that offer audiobooks. So we're out there, and we encourage people to kind of just step back and indulge yourself in the theater of the imagination.
Anthony, it's always a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you. Thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
It's always a pleasure, Peter, and thank you very much for setting me straight when I was a kid.
Anthony D.P. Mann. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0569, and you'll find links to Anthony's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Lately, there's been something else to spot in the sky. It's the comet Neowise. Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy, is here to talk about it and the satellite it is named after. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
So tell us what we know, what you know about the comet known as Neowise, and also a little bit about the satellite it's named after.
Yeah, so basically we're talking about a giant snowball, if you can think about it that. We're not sure exactly the size yet, but it, you know, comets like this range in size from a few hundred meters to a few kilometers across. This particular comet, we think it comes from a giant reservoir of frozen comets out at the edge of the solar system. So this is even way beyond the orbit of Pluto, where we're talking about. And we think there's billions of these in kind of in hibernation mode, these comets, just really frozen. It's like minus 180 degrees there. So they're just frozen rock solid. And every once in a while, however, the gravitational pull of the sun pulls them in towards the inner solar system. And that's the journey that Neowise has been undergoing. And believe it or not, it's taken 6,000 years for this comet to make that journey from the edge of the solar system beyond Pluto to where it is now within the orbit of Mercury. And the comet itself was discovered back in late March by one of NASA's satellites that's in orbit. It's called Neowise. It's basically an infrared space telescope that was really launched back in 2009 and used for looking at deep sky stuff, things like star clusters, looking through the veil of dust that covers a lot of objects in space. It could penetrate through that using the infrared vision that it had. However, the coolant that is required, there is a coolant on board the space satellite, ran out in 2011. And they, astronomers had to rethink of what they're going to use the satellite for. And they realized that it could still be used to hunt asteroids. And so it was rededicated. And in 2013, since then, until now, it's still going. It's been searching for asteroids that are near Earth, that cross Earth's orbit, that could be of danger of collision with Earth one day.
So basically, it's an early warning system of, oh, now I see what's coming. Nothing I can do about it, but I know it's there.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we don't really know what we could do with it. But yes, it's an early warning system. And, you know, these objects are called near-Earth objects. And hence, that's why the WISE satellite, as it was originally known, is now known as the NEOWISE satellite. And on March 27th, on one of the survey photos that it takes of looking for asteroids in space, found an object that wasn't an asteroid, wasn't a star, but in fact was a comet. And so now the comet is named after the telescope that first discovered it, NEOWISE.
Now, one of the things I find is very interesting is that this is apparently something that you can see with the naked eye and certainly see with a decent pair of binoculars, but you got to get up really early in the morning to do that. But later in the month of July, the time that you will be able to see this will be at a more reasonable hour of the day as it progresses, correct?
Yeah, so right now you really got to get up at the crack of dawn. This is primarily visible for northern hemisphere folks, north of the equator. You got to get up about at least an hour before your local sunrise. Look towards the northeast. That's where all the action is happening. Make sure you find a spot that has no obstruction of the view of your low horizon, northeast horizon, so no buildings or trees or anything like that. And a great guidepost is this bright, brilliant, bright star, white star. It's the brightest star you'll see in the sky that time of the day, in the early morning. And to the left, look to the left of that star. That star, by the way, is planet Venus. It's not a star, our neighboring world. And just look to the left of it, and you'll see a little cotton, what looks like a cotton ball hanging in the sky. That is NEOWISE. And with a pair of binoculars, you'll be able to see there's a stubby tail, that iconic tail that comets have, is just sweeping away opposite from where the sun is in the sky. And as we go later in the week into mid-July, it's going to be going farther and farther away from the sun. And for us here on Earth, it'll be rising earlier and earlier. And at one point, we'll be able to see it mid-July, up near where, just underneath where the Big Dipper group of stars are in the northeastern sky at around local midnight time, your local midnight time.
And one of the things I think scientists would say that was rather remarkable is that a lot of times when they have these comets that are heading toward the sun or close to the sun in that general direction, that they usually burn up. But this is not happening with this particular one.
That's right. And this is what caught everyone off guard, because we knew about this comet since late March, and that we've been keeping tabs on it. And then sure enough, we knew, we projected that it would be sweeping around the sun last week, early July. And so the NASA trained its sun-watching satellites on the sun to watch all of this action unfold. And the photos that the satellite sent back showed us that it didn't disintegrate like they thought it would, because, of course, it's made of ice and the heat from the sun and the gravitational pull. You'd think that it'd be pulled apart. Most comets would. But this one didn't. It actually survived and started brightening in just after like the Independence Day weekend in North America, July 4th. After that, it's been increasing. And every day since, the show is getting better. The comet is being reported as being brighter and brighter to the naked eye.
Now, you said that it is moving away from the sun. So is it now heading back in the direction it came from, or is it going past the sun?
No, it's actually whipping around the sun and heading back out in the general same area from where it came from. And so that's just kind of like almost like 90 degrees from the plane of the solar system, from all the orbits of the planets. So for that's why folks in the northern hemisphere can see it, but in the southern hemisphere of Earth, it's not visible. It's underneath their horizon.
Okay.
So it's going out, and it'll take another 4,000 years to reach its destination.
Which is where, do we know?
Yeah, well, it's in what's called the Oort cloud, this donut-shaped region that is the reservoir of all these comets. So it's going back home. It's way beyond the orbit of Pluto.
So Do we have any ideas or any speculation as to whether this thing has been picking up any debris on its travel to us? And will it pick up more debris on its travel back? In other words, do we have any way of knowing if this looks any different than it originally did when it started its journey?
Well, we don't know that we don't have any close-up views of it. It'll take a large telescope to be able to spy on it closely. Perhaps the Hubble would be directed to it if the astronomers think that it's worthy of it. There's no doubt that the appearance of the comet has changed, and that's because of its close encounter with the sun. So you have to remember this is like a mixture of rock, ice, and gas pockets buried underneath, and being exposed to the sun so much, it's probably fractured the comet, releasing a lot of that gas, like geysers exploding into deep space. So it's a very dynamic, a thing in space, and it's very violent, and it's going through all these convulsions, basically now releasing all this material, lots of dust and gas, and that's what's forming the tail and causing it to glow so brightly.
Do we have any idea if its encounter with the sun had an effect on its trajectory, on its path in any way, shape, or form?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The fact that it came, had a close encounter with the sun itself kind of whipped it around itself, and it's changed its speed. It's actually faster. And so while it took about 6,000 years to come into the solar system, being pulled into the sun, now it's probably going to, because it's going faster, the estimation is about 4,000 years that it'll take to reach its destination.
Does its speed have anything to do with what you just said, the its effects in dealing with the sun, or is any part of that the boomerang effect?
Yeah, it's pretty much it is kind of like the boomerang effect, but it's the gravitational swing around the sun. So the fact that this huge, ball of gas that's at the center of our solar system, it's like a well of gravity. And it just pulled this tiny little object close in and it whipped it around gravitationally. And it's now the sun is basically whipping it back out into the outer solar system at a much higher speed, therefore taking less time to reach the Oort cloud from where it came out in the edge of the solar system.
Fascinating stuff indeed, and something that people can take a look at in the night skies or the early morning skies, depending how you look at it, over the next little while. Are there websites people can go to find out more information about when and where they can see it, depending upon where they live?
Yeah, there's a great international site where people can see daily what it's looking like. So if you're wondering, is it worth for me to get up in the morning at the crack of dawn? Well, there's a website called spaceweather.com that'll show you, that basically logs every people photographs and their observations of the comet on a daily basis. And you can see the comet evolve over time. And people are, they've actually created a gallery where international folks from all continents are sending in their pictures. And you can take pictures easily with a small digital camera of the comet yourself.
Excellent stuff. Always a pleasure having you on, Andrew. Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Well, my pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy and the author of Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0569, and you'll find links to his site and also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now. 44-year-old Don Peters was arrested without incident on July 4th, according to Akron, Ohio police, after forcing his way around the counter at a Subway sandwich shop and making his own sandwich. According to police, Peters was intoxicated when he entered the store, demanding a meal, and became belligerent, damaging some plexiglass before charging behind the counter. Officers said they found a bottle of vodka and a block of Subway cheese in Peters' pockets. He was charged with disorderly conduct, criminal damaging, and having an open container. Wow. Just like Jared, he's going from Subway to jail. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
A man who fired a gun into a murder victim's grave during a burial service has been sentenced to 15 years in federal prison. Way back on November 22, 2017, Elton Stevenson of Chicago drew a handgun at Evergreen Cemetery and fired a single shot into the grave of a man who had been murdered 2 days earlier. "You ain't bleep. You got what you deserved," he said before firing the shot. Stevenson then waved the gun in the direction of the mourners and fled. He was arrested a short time later near the entrance of the cemetery. Well, the wheels of justice apparently move very slowly. Flash forward to now, as Stevenson pleaded guilty to one count of illegal possession of a firearm by a previously convicted felon. That's how he got sentenced to 15 years in federal prison. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're a convicted felon who isn't allowed to have a firearm, would you feel it's necessary to stop by, armed, and in front of grieving family and friends, i.e. witnesses, to shoot up the casket of what we can only assume has to be an already dead guy who is just moments away from his eternal dirt nap? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0569. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0569. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.